Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast.
Today on the Indie Opera Podcast. We have an interview with Elena Langer, the composer of Four Sisters. And Royce Vavrick will join us for a detour from our usual opera agenda and talk about the Oscars.
What you've been going through, that's a tough deal.
I'm just trying to keep my head above water.
I miss heavy hole, bro.
I'm all here with your stories. We all are.
At war! We are at war!
I promise you that I'll look after him. If I can, I'll return him to your care.
He's my also.
And we announce the Indie Opera Podcast contest winner.
How good a professional musician, a practicing teacher,
okay, welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast. This is Peter.
And this is Noah.
And this is Royce.
Hey, Royce, welcome.
I'm excited to be here again.
So we've decided to not really take a break from opera, but to take a little detour.
Yeah.
For the Oscars, since I know that you're an Oscar maven.
Sort of, yes. Or an Oscar fanatic or something to that effect, yes.
And you're actually, you went to film school, so you have
I did.
You have some cred.
Well, a wee bit, perhaps. Not at all.
So I think, yeah, you've got the most cred on the podcast when it comes to film. If you went to film school. I didn't go to film school. Peter didn't go to film school, right?
Not yet.
But beyond that, I've been watching the Oscars since 1990 when I was 7 years old and became really, really, really into them and started following them like a voracious something or other in 96, maybe? Yeah.
So, Royce, I wanted to know, for somebody who has been watching the Oscars since, you said, what, 1990?
Yeah.
Okay, so what, have you ever had any upsets?
Oh, yeah, totally. I remember, well, nominations-wise, I remember my parents only had two channels. I come from a small city in northern Alberta, Canada, so we had two channels. One was CTV and one was CBC, so we never could hear the Oscar nominations being announced. And back in the day, you know, 15 years ago, they didn't broadcast them or live stream them like they do now on the internet. So I remember waking my friend up at 6:38 in the morning one year. It was the year of Titanic, so like 98, I guess. Mm-hmm. And listening to the nominations through the telephone. She held her telephone up to the speakers of her TV. And I remember screaming at 6:38 when Adam Egoyan received his nominations for Best Director and Best Adapted Screenplay in for The Sweet Hereafter. That just like completely was not something, it was remotely a possibility back then, it seemed. So that was really super cool. And then winning wise, when Juliette Binoche won for The English Patient, that was a year that everybody and their dog was saying that Lauren Bacall, it was a slam dunk for her. And so for Juliette to win was huge. And similarly, the year that Marcia Gay Harden won for Pollock, that was a huge upset. A lot of people.
Who did she win over?
A lot of people, including like Roger Ebert and stuff, were predicting Kate Hudson for Almost Famous.
Oh right, okay.
She had won quite a few of the precursors.
Okay, Kate. Now listen, kids. First of all, I've been watching the Oscars since the 70s.
So. Ooh. Yes.
I've got you both. Second of all, I wanted to get some of the opera stuff out of the way before we fell deep into the Oscar hole.
All these O words. Yeah.
News. one bit of news is Elmer Gantry. Did you hear about this?
Well, that it won 3 Grammys?
I think it won 2.
Grammys. Oh, okay. I thought 3.
It was nominated for 3. It actually won 2. It won Best Contemporary Classical Composition.
Mm-hmm.
And it also won Best Engineered Album. And the reason I wanted to mention it is that it was the recording of Milwaukee Florentine Opera Company. Now, if that doesn't sound indie, I don't know what is.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I'm really glad that he won. He's actually, I met Robert a few times. He teaches at Montclair here in New Jersey, and it was a big splash when they first did it in, how many years ago was that?
Okay. Isn't Montclair State University, isn't that where all of Harry Parch's instruments are?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Let's see. The other bit of news. Just this really interesting opera we've never mentioned. I wanted to get out there. It's called Anya 17. Have you heard about this?
No.
It's an opera about sex trafficking in the UK.
Oh, okay. Is it written, is it by a British?
Yeah, are you looking it up? I hear.
Yeah, that's okay. We can do that, right?
Yeah.
Well, it sounds really interesting. Hold on. Anya 17. Cool.
And it's composed by Adam Gorb. Is Roy still there?
I am here.
All right.
Have you
ever heard of Adam Gorb?
I haven't.
Apparently, this is a powerful narrative revolving around 4 young women deceived and trafficked from Eastern Europe as they struggle to survive in a secret world seemingly devoid of hope or compassion.
Wow, sounds like a toe-tapper.
that's coming up let me see, it's March 7th, 9th, etc., and that's over in the Epstein Theater in Liverpool. So if anyone's listening in England, there's a really wonderful thing going on in Liverpool. Let me see, another bit of news, and this is another London-based news. Let's see. Do you remember Noah, a singer named Noah Stewart?
Yeah.
Well, Noah Stewart.
No, I know Noah Stewart. He's a tenor.
Yeah, and
he's incredible.
Yeah, he is amazing. And he is performing in Judith Weir's new opera called Miss Fortune.
Okay.
You heard about it?
No.
So he's playing the role of Hassan, which who knows if that's a big role. But anyway, I was really excited to read that he's going to be performing with at the Royal Opera, Covent Garden. That's March 12th, 16th, 20th, 23rd, and 28th. And I want to put that out there because we really love Noah and think he's an amazing performer.
Yeah, he's
and,
incredible. He's got one of those high-flying tenor voices that are, it's just like easy and it's an incredible sound.
And he also
busy month. My God.
He's also been he also released a music video. I guess I'll post a link to it.
Without a song, the day would never end. Without a song, the road would never bend. When things go wrong, a man ain't got a friend. Without a song.
And let's see, the only other bit of news I have is I actually did an interview for this. I interviewed Elena Langer, who's a composer. She lives in London, but she's originally from Russia. Do you know Elena?
I do. I actually, when David Little and I premiered scenes from Dog Days, I believe she had a piece on that Don Upshaw, Osvaldo Goliath concert back in 2009. Yeah.
Also, we should mention, of course, Song from the Uproar is coming out.
Oh, yeah.
Be silly not to mention it, right? Song from the Uproar, about music by Missy Mazzoli, films by Stephen Taylor, directed by Gia Farakis. Am I saying all this right?
Gia Farakis?
Gia Farakis, I'm sorry. And it's the premiere. It's at The Kitchen, February 24th, 25th, and March 1st through 3rd.
And Royce is, of course, the librettist for that.
Yeah.
I am.
So Elena Langer wrote this opera called Four Sisters. It's going to be done up at Bard. And I called her. She was in London at the time, and probably it was the middle of the night. But anyway, here's the interview with Elena. So we're on the line with Elena Langer, who has written compositions in diverse genres, including opera and multimedia, orchestral, chamber, and choral works, and has received commissions and performances from international ensembles, festivals, and organizations, such as the Royal Opera House, Zurich Opera, the Amida Festival, among others. She will also be having a premiere with the Kronos Quartet in 2013 and the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players in their following season as well. And welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Good to be here.
It's great to talk to you. This piece we're working on, it's called Four Sisters, mm-hmm. and it'll be premiering at Bard.
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about how this came about.
Well, Don Upshaw phoned me and asked to write an opera for Bard. And I thought that since it's going to be performed by a very young cast, and usually a beautiful cast and a nice cast and talented, I thought that we maybe have to come up with a new subject, contemporary theme, something with the young people at the center of the piece. I was looking through various ideas, and I was sharing these ideas with a friend of mine, John Lloyd Davis, who is a director, and he works at the Royal Opera House. He is in charge of a little theater in the basement called the Lindbury Studio, where they premiere a lot of contemporary operas. And he has a lot of experience with staging contemporary opera. And he just wanted to try to write a new libretto for me.
Great. Now, have you actually been to Bard yet?
Yes, I've been to Bard when we were rehearsing a piece of mine for the Carnegie Hall. We were staying there for a few days.
Are you planning on being here for the premiere?
Yes, absolutely. I'm coming and I'm going to spend 2 weeks at Bard. I'm looking forward to that a lot.
And when are they starting rehearsals?
They are starting, they've already been rehearsing with piano and voices. And the orchestra starts on Thursday, and it's very exciting because I'm just finishing the orchestration.
Now?
Yes, now.
Now,
actually, I feel a bit asocial at the moment because I only think about notes and trombone mutes and strings divisi and all kinds of things.
So let's just put in a little plug for James Bagwell, who will be conducting. James is a really wonderful conductor. He's been actually doing a lot of work mm-hmm. around town. He works with the American Symphony Orchestra as well as other groups. And he teaches at Bard as well. So let's talk a little bit about your composition. Now, it sounds like you have a very complete classical composition education.
Well, yes, it's hard to avoid it because I studied at the Moscow Conservatoire, where we had a very strict and good classical training.
Tell me, working with Americans, what has it been like for you? Do you find the musicianship to be very different, or what is the attitude different?
Well, I worked in England for many years and in Europe a bit and in the States. It's been very nice. I had pieces done at Carnegie and at Tanglewood, and everything. What strikes me is that everything sounds polished and perfect, and the quality is very high.
Yeah, I always find that too. I'm amazed. The young singers, it's amazing. At least here in New York, people come in audition, and it's one wonderful singer after another, and they're young and they're raring to go. The American training is very diverse. Like, they don't just study the classical repertoire. They go all over the map. Is Russia as experimental, or is it still much more conservative there?
Oh, not at all. I graduated in 1999, and in Russia everything is changing very rapidly. So since I haven't been there for a while, it's hard to say. But I felt a definite lack with contemporary technique when I graduated. So I studied in London as well. I did my PhD here, and I specifically paid a lot of attention to contemporary scores, which we didn't very much look at the conservatoire in Moscow.
Right, and a lot of the training here in the United States in the 60s and 70s, a lot of the Russians came here. So it helped actually ground Americans' training, got a little more classical. And we've always had a little bit of jealousy towards the Russian pianists. I remember growing up playing and going, wow, they're all so amazing.
Yes, but there are too many of them. Yeah. They need to be shot.
There are, I don't know if there's too many of them, but there are an awful lot of them.
I used to play piano, I used to be a pianist, and my professor would say, if I could glue your bottom to the stool, you could become a very good pianist. But it was a bit boring because so much of it is just physical repetition and getting it
into your fingers. Yeah.
And again, unless you feel that you're going to be Evgeny Kissin, there's no point in doing this. And again, the repertoire is very classical, and everybody plays that same Chopin fantasy again and again. And
right. So when you were writing for this opera, it sounds like you sort of went outside of that box. Your description says you're using Caribbean style music and all sorts of things.
Yes, a lot of new things for me. I feel even uncertain. I feel very excited, but like a little student, like I'm trying completely new territories.
And it says you also use some klezmer influences on this as well.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I'm using all kinds of things because I have three young girls in the center, and each one needs a completely different music.
And is this influenced? Is the story at all influenced by Chekhov's Three Sisters?
Well, it's a kind of weird mixture in the libretto. It's a mixture of Three Sisters and Sex in the City.
Oh.
four young girls, and they have Russian names, but it's very, very far from Chekhov, very far.
And what happens in the piece?
All sisters are born from different mothers, and they have one very rich, eccentric father who recently died and left a will. And so they're looking forward to getting this money, splitting this money. They have their dreams. Each sister has a dream. One wants to go to Florida. Another one wants to go to California. And they think that all this money will make them happy. But
sounds like a Chekhov story.
No, it's much jollier than Chekhov.
I find Chekhov very humorous, actually.
Yes, it is humorous. I think he's one of my favorite writers.
Yeah, I just saw a production of The Cherry Orchard that was very funny.
Well, you would never see a funny production of that in Russia.
Really?
Yes. Somehow it's all very serious and grim.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's depressing. So tell me a little bit more about the piece. Is it full orchestra, or what are we talking about?
It's full. It's a big full orchestra, double wind, two percussionists. I'm using. I'm actually using steel drums for my Caribbean music, and I'm using tambourines and car sirens and all kinds of things in the percussion section.
And is it a one act or?
It's a one act, 45 minutes long.
And
it's in a double bill with Rameau, a Baroque opera about relationships as well.
When you were writing it, did you know who would be singing the roles?
I knew the thing is that I had an experience with the Bard students before, and as we discussed, the technique was flawless, and I had this feeling that I can write anything and they would just sing anything I write. So I didn't know this particular lot, but I knew the standard was very high.
I'm going to try and make it up there if I can, up to Bard.
Oh, that would be nice. Yes. But I don't think it will be boring. I can almost guarantee you it will not be boring.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you. Have a good night.
Well, me too. You too. It's very nice talking to you.
Great speaking to you. See you.
Take care. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I have seen everything in the Best Picture category except for Extremely Loud, Incredibly Close, and War Horse.
No, you go, Royce. I've seen everything but Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, so we are praying to God that Noah has done his Extremely Loud homework.
No, I've been bad. I mean, I'm a little bit of like a monomaniac, you know? Like, I get into one thing, and then that's what I'm doing, and like... So I've seen Tree of Life, of course, and I've seen the play War Horse, and that made, and I saw that 2 weeks ago, and I just, now I feel like I'll never see the movie.
Okay.
Then we can talk about that more later, but like, I have not seen Extremely Loud, but I would be interested to see that one. I don't know if I'd like it, but I'd be interested to see that one.
So now let's talk about Extremely Loud and sort of knock it out quickly.
Listen to me, I'm gonna be home in about 20 minutes.
No, you listen to me. We broke a window to let in some air. Now I'm gonna be okay.
The building and there was smoke everywhere. They're trying to save us.
Where are you?
I'm on the 106th floor.
An American Airlines plane was hijacked.
Thomas, you listen to me. And you come home.
I'm gonna be fine. I'm gonna try to call you again in a few minutes.
Please just stay talking to me.
I think that there's a lot of people either love that movie or have hated that movie. At least that's right. Sort of the buzz about it.
And I do know that the criticisms... Oh, I'm sorry. My Oscar webpage is playing in the background. I do know that the criticism that I hear of it most often is not something that I understand. Like, I've heard from a few people being like, I just think it's cheap to use 9/11 to tug at the heartstrings.
Right.
And that just doesn't feel right to me because it's like, well, but... anything's allowed in film. Like, I don't think there should be any prohibition on subject matter.
Right.
Just as a blanket thing.
So I guess I'm going to go see it. I'll go see it tomorrow.
Okay.
And you can make an addendum to the exactly. podcast.
So then let's, do you want to talk, should we like hit on each of the 10 or 9 pictures?
Okay. First of all, do you guys have a pony in the race that you're really pulling for, even against all odds, if that's the case?
I do not have a pony in the race. I have a few that I really felt were good films, but I think there's a difference between being a really good film and winning the best picture.
Right. Well, and that's what the criticism of this year in general is that there's no movie that has just completely captured the cultural pulse or what have you, except for maybe The Artist, which I think is a really, really good film. But certainly doesn't capture my imagination the way that Social Network did last year or any of the other auteurist pieces last year or in previous years. There certainly have been films that I've just been super, super passionate about. But none of these 9 movies are really like make me want to go to bat for it.
Right. I also think that a lot of the like Moneyball, Midnight in Paris, these are not straightforward films like Moneyball. When we doesn't really, the team doesn't win at the end. It's not an easy, like, you know, oh, we love it, they won kind of movie.
Right, right.
You know, it's a more sophisticated ending, you know. The Tree of Life is very confusing as far as, like, you know, what are we talking about here? War Horse, also. All these issues, these are not like a Gump or a movie that so obviously is aimed at winning the best film.
You know? Like before when we were talking about Oscar wins or upsets, I remember that I cared about the Oscars in the 90s when I was in high school or I watched them or I took them like more seriously. And then I remember when Crash won Best Picture.
Yeah.
That was it. That kind of messed me up.
Because
I felt like that film was... the biggest like charade I've ever like I can't even believe that anyone would ever give it any awards, you know,
right?
And so much less win but Best Picture, you know. But it kind of when you think about it, like what are the Oscars for? Is it supposed to be for the best film, or is it supposed to be for the most celebrated film, or for the most loved film? Like what do you think the Oscars should be? What kinds of films should win?
Yeah, I mean, I remember 2004 when Million Dollar Baby won.
Mm-hmm.
And it was up against someone else who I thought really deserved to win.
What else was going on?
I'm trying to remember. It was 2004. But I remember thinking, wow, this movie just didn't, for me, didn't deserve it. because it was just so obvious. It was obvious how you should feel about her. It was obvious to me in film. I don't want a film that leaves me with a definite good guy, bad guy. I like one that makes me go,
Right, I agree.
You know, one that has subtlety and artistry and brings up questions that you think about 2 days later. You know, Million Dollar Baby, it was like, all right, you won. Yeah, I wasn't excited about it.
I was actually kind of excited about it. I remember leaving the cinema and thinking that it was a really, really good film from an American maverick, Mr. Eastwood.
Right. Yeah.
And that performance was great. And I remember not knowing the twist, that event that happens halfway through the film.
Right.
It knocked my socks off.
I really liked the film too, and I never see twists, so I didn't see that one at all.
I saw that. I remember the twist and being surprised by it, but I actually felt let down by it and kind of disappointed and led around by the nose.
Mm. It's certainly not the worst Best Picture win.
No.
I liked that film. I didn't feel like, you know, it's almost like, did you see The Fighter? When was that, last year?
Yeah.
Like, I loved The Fighter, but I also didn't feel like it was trying to punch above its weight. Like, it was this kind of story told in this way, and it was very well done, I thought, you know?
Yeah.
And I like films like that. I don't have a problem with movies that just deliver, kind of stand and deliver kind of movies.
Okay, so let's talk about, let's get War Horse. We're going to hit each one of these. Let's talk about War Horse.
Can you imagine flying over a war? And you know you can never look down. You have to look forward, or you'll never get home.
Okay, I'm not going to see it for one. I'll never see this movie, and I'll never see it for one reason.
Why?
And it's the same. It's my problem with Equus becoming a film. It's when you have something that is about, the work is so kind of about dealing with this object that's not a horse and taking it seriously as a horse. When that is like the central device of the storytelling, I don't know why they turn around in film and use a real horse. I don't understand why they would, I don't see how that, I feel like that they're almost kind of kicking their own stools out from under themselves. Like they're really, they're giving themselves a problem right from the beginning, you know?
It's a really beautiful play. I was in tears, and I kept telling myself this isn't a real animal, but...
Who cares, though?
It was such a beautiful construction. So what did you think, Royce, of War Horse?
Of the movie? I love the play as well. The movie, it was just a little, it was a little cheesy, you know? But it was also, my favorite actress, bar none, working today is Emily Watson. So I went in really, really, really hoping to God that this would be like the performance that would bring her some big blockbuster attention. And you know, it let me down. Okay. But it was fine. I took my mom over Christmas.
If we've talked about this, but you must love Breaking the Waves then.
Yeah, Breaking the Waves is probably my favorite piece of cinema ever.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. I just rewatched it a couple weeks ago with people who had never seen it before, and I think it's just kind of the most astonishing film. Yeah,
I saw it when I was like 14 or 13.
I wouldn't have gotten it, I don't think, if I was
young.
Yeah,
I was just I fell in love with it then, and it's remained. I actually have a poster of it hanging in my
apartment. And you know what? It's really hard to get a good copy of it, like on DVD. Like, there's all these foreign copies of it that make you change the region on your DVD player. And I don't think there's a really good Blu-ray edition of it. It's like, what's going on, guys? Like,
and Lars von Trier, bless that man's heart, even in light of all of these wacky things he's been saying. But he for me is the finest filmmaker working today. And all three of those films in his Golden Heart trilogy, which began with Breaking the Waves and then continued with The Idiots. And
oh my God, that's like maybe my second favorite. I love The Idiots.
Good. Yeah. Oh my God. And then the Dancer in the Dark completed that trilogy. Yeah. Those occupy such a huge place in my heart.
Yeah.
Those movies, man.
With you on those.
And the fact Lars von Trier has been nominated for one Oscar, and that is for Best Original Song back in 2000 or I don't know if the
for Dancer in the Dark, the one with Dancer York,
2001. But he for I've Seen It All. But isn't that crazy that
it was a great song though?
It's an amazing song. It's my favorite song on that album though.
Oh, I remember. Yeah, I was a senior in high school when that came out, and I listened to that track over and over and over and over.
Me too. I remember skipping the latter part of my day when I went and bought the copy of the show and sat there for 3 hours in the afternoon and watched Breaking the Waves.
What's the line with the gear?
you guys, this is gonna be a 5 hour long podcast.
Okay.
Wait a second. Breaking the Waves. I've never seen it, and frankly,
I'm gonna sit you down and make you watch this movie with me, and then you're gonna cry, and then I'm gonna watch you dehydrate like a raisin.
The thing that makes me cry is that if I watched it when I came out, I would have been 30 years old, and you just said you would have been in high school.
Well, you know,
and you were 17.
Love that movie. Anyways, back to the
Why is Melancholia not get anything? I mean,
this is why I want to actually ask you guys if you guys had read this article that was published in the LA Times a couple days ago, or maybe it was yesterday. But they did a survey. I'm actually pulling it up here. The title is Oscar Voters Overwhelmingly White Male.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here is the demographics. It says a Los Angeles Times study found the Academy voters are markedly less diverse than the movie-going public, and even more monolithic than many in the film industry may suspect. Oscar voters are nearly 94% Caucasian and 77% male, the Times found. Blacks are about 2% of the Academy, and Latinos are less than 2%. And there is a median age of 62.
Oh, this is like Archie Bunker's picking these movies.
Yeah, Archie Bunker doesn't watch Melancholia. It is wild that they sprung for Tree of Life.
I think I was so, because you asked about A Horse in the Race, and I was like, I was originally, you know, before the nominees came out, I'd be like, I don't have A Horse in the Race, because the two films I think that are my favorite films of this year are Tree of Life, which I'm totally devoted to it, and then We Need to Talk About Kevin, which didn't get nominated at all,
right.
But yeah, Tree of Life is up for a bunch of things, and I don't even care if it wins, because I'm just so I'm so excited that it's being nominated, that it's getting, like, you know, people are paying attention to it.
Okay, let's
talk
just for a second for the people who are listening. Melancholia was directed by Lars von Trier, if you can put that all together.
And it's about the end of the world.
And it's about the end of the world, and it was not nominated. I did not see it, but now that you guys are gushing about it, I have to.
That one I wouldn't gush about. I wouldn't gush about that one, actually. But I mean, I loved it, but I don't.
Oh, it's certainly one of my top five of the year.
It's one of my top five of the year, but of his films, because his films are so incredible. It's not one of my favorite films by him, although I do like it very much, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen it a few times, and I still struggle with the middle of it, you know? So I don't know. It's worth seeing. Everyone, you should see it, because the guy makes incredible film.
All right, so let's
a really cool use of music as well.
Oh yeah, it's
Tristan. A little overwhelming, but I think that it's still a really lovely and sophisticated use of music.
Which is
Tristan. Wow. It's the prelude from Tristan and Isolde. It keeps playing over and over and over.
It does in the opera too.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the Tree of Life. Now, I did see The Tree of Life, at least I think I did. Like, yes. I'm thinking back on it, I'm wondering what I saw. Like, what was that movie about again?
What was it about to you?
Exactly.
See, I think that answer is given so simply. I think that's why it's able to go in so kind of into this crazy place that it does, is because it's really just about this family growing up in Texas, right? These kids growing up in this family in Texas. I mean, the basic structure of the story is pretty simple. Just like most works that are absolutely crazy start with a very simple premise, you know?
But they're trying to hook into these universal ideas, right?
Yeah, the micro and the macro.
The micro and the macro. Yeah,
but to me, it just seemed like a Getty film search for clips. I mean, it seemed like, all right, let's talk about eternity and then throw in every image we can think of that's stereotypical of this concept. The earth, the sun, I mean, all these things. To me, it was like, I mean, I do Getty searches to edit films together, and that's the kind of footage you get. Mm-hmm. So I found it a little annoying, and that I would love to like compare it to, let's say, Chekhov, who does the same thing. He takes a small story with universal themes, but does it in a way that really knocks my socks off. With this one, I got a little annoyed. I was like, okay, why am I staring at an image of a burning cigarette? Or why am
I... No, I think I understand that criticism. I think that all of that stuff, all of those shots were very risky, I think, because he's trying to give you a kind of web of association between what's going on in the narrative and between what's going on in front of you.
Right.
He's trying to kind of ask you to associate, but in a very free way. I think if you try to pin down exactly what something means in this film, you end up missing what he's trying to do. You know, I think he casts back it to the beginning of the world.
Right.
Precisely because he wants to show it and to ruminate on it, and not because he's using it to say anything.
I think
does that make sense?
Yeah, I understand that, but it happens so soon in the film, like so close at the beginning, that he hasn't earned my trust to get so abstract. Like, it starts off so abstract that I'm so lost until we get into the story. I sort of feel like he does it at the wrong moment. Like,
I think you're right. I think that there's a feeling, even when you watch it in a theater, that as soon as you go to the cosmos, basically you feel like everybody in the theater is kind of going, come on, am I going to get lost? Is this movie going to lose me? But I think what happens is once you get back into the family scenes, it's like you can't help but be brought back, and then it almost forces you to reconsider the cosmos thing, to bring it back into your analysis, even if you've rejected it.
Yeah, I just wish that we had settled into the family thing a little more firmly first before we went on the field trip and the hike in the woods to the universe, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Those performances, though.
Oh, they're incredible, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Hunter McCracken, who plays...
Oh, my God.
I think he's the eldest son. And Jessica Chastain, who really should be nominated for Best Supporting Actress for Tree of Life. Or I would actually have nominated her for her amazing performance in Take Shelter. I don't know if you guys...
I've heard about it. I've heard it's great.
Man. She's had an amazing year. A lot has been said about Jessica Chastain in this year that's just been so rich with like 5 performances that she gave that were really quite... They were stunners.
Yeah. And I really like Brad Pitt in Tree of Life. I mean, I liked Moneyball and everything, and he's the central, he sort of holds Moneyball together. But still, I think as a performance, as a leading actor, like just acting, I think the Tree of Life, he's much better.
Yeah, it's sort of an iconic performance in a way. And it's interesting. Moneyball is a much bigger showcase and made more money, and it's all about him. I think that Brad Pitt could have legitimately been placed in the supporting role category for his performance in Tree of Life.
Oh yeah, that's true.
But yeah, I think I actually really am a huge fan of his work in Moneyball, and I'm a big fan of that picture.
Right.
The other thing that's really funny about it is that two summers ago, when I was doing I'm reading Heidegger, reading Being in Time, I was using these podcasts, and this guy, Professor Dreyfus at UC Berkeley, right in the middle of his lecture was like, by the way, if anybody knows of this film director, Terrence Malick, you should go and see his movies. He's only made about 4 movies because Tree of Life hadn't come out then. And he's like, but he's a Heideggerian. He published, he got a PhD in Heidegger studies. Oh. And immediately, like upon getting his PhD and publishing this one dissertation on Heidegger, turned around and became a filmmaker.
Oh.
And so it's like, it was kind of like, there's a lot of people in philosophy who talk about like, are his films kind of philosophical, or are they kind of just films, or is there more philosophy here than in other films? Like that, those are questions that are always kind of going with his films, you know? And so I just think it's like, it's such a monumentally huge movie that just even to have it nominated is exciting.
I only wish that they had not actually cast. I mean, I know Brad Pitt did a great job. I sort of wish they had cast no names in all of the roles, because then I would have thought a little more about the universal themes, I kept being reminded that it was Brad Pitt, you know? I kept being reminded of... And Brad Pitt's not a very universal human kind of a guy. He's a little, I don't know, unearthly or superhuman in some way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, why do you say that?
Well, he just takes me out of the story. I cannot look at him and not think Brad Pitt. You know, I'd rather be thinking man with wife and issues in a movie. It just...
See, I don't have that problem with him. I have it more with Sean Penn.
Oh, other
really?
Yeah, I see that with Sean Penn. I have problems looking at watching him and taking him. I'm seeing Sean Penn. I'm not seeing
even in him. Even in something like Milk.
No, see those things. He really, of course, that's a great film, and he really disappears in that one. And does
Forget Man out. Walking.
No, same thing. Like that's way far back. But I mean, like in this one, and then I remember in I Am Sam. I love Tree of Life, but I still think it has flaws, and not that his parts are flawed, but there are times in that film where I wish it wasn't true. But I'm sitting there going, "Oh, Sean Penn."
Yeah, right.
I just can't. You know, I don't know why. I don't know what it is about.
Right.
Maybe it's the setting. Maybe it's what he's being asked to do. Maybe, I don't know. You know, he's a tricky actor.
That theme's going to come up again when we talk about some of our later movies. So let's move to Moneyball.
We're going to shake things up. Why don't you walk me through the board?
I believe there's a championship team that we could afford because everyone else undervalues them, like an island of misfit toys.
We want you at first base.
I've only ever played catcher.
It's not that hard, Scott. Tell him, Wash.
It's incredibly hard.
He can't throw.
But what can he do?
You want me to speak?
We're not pointing you yet.
He gets on base.
We are card counters at the black.
I actually love Moneyball. I don't know if it deserves to be Best Picture, but I'm not a big like baseball fan. I've gone to games as a kid and stuff, but it totally captivated me. I love the structure of it. I love the fact that they don't win, even though that's a historical truth and it was a historical movie.
Dude, you're blowing. Yeah. Right?
Well, I mean, if you think they're gonna win. I'm pretty sure.
I thought they were going to win. I haven't seen the movie yet. It's called Moneyball. It's about something having to do with money and baseball. And it's, I don't know. Somebody could win in the end.
The film is much, much more than that. It's certainly not a film about this team that may lose.
Yeah, totally. It's not about, and that's what I like about it. It's not about whether they win or lose. It's about this man's struggle to change the way people engage in the act of playing football. Mm-hmm. Baseball. I absolutely adored this film. I loved it.
And you say that you don't think that it deserves to be a Best Picture nominee.
There was nothing about it that also made me at the end of the film want to think about it anymore. Like, I don't want to see it again. And I think that really great art, and that, I mean, this is where the argument comes up. The thing that wins Best Picture isn't usually the best art, but I'm always looking for the best art. And for me, I want a film that I want to see again in 3 months and another year. And to me, that makes a great film, something that you can live with over time. And Moneyball doesn't fit that category for me.
See, I don't play the art film versus entertainment film game.
Okay.
At all.
Why?
Because when I'm entertained by something, I'm just entertained. It's like activating the same mechanism in me that things that are great, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like it's, you're still watching a film. You're still taking something in.
Right, no, I think that a great art film should be the best picture. I just don't think that those are the films that win. Like, The Tree of Life, it might be great art. I just don't think it's the kind of film that's going to win.
I question the idea that there is even such a thing as an art film versus a, you know what I mean? Like, I think that there's just films.
No, I'm not. You're saying art film. I'm just saying to be a great work, you know? I think Moneyball is a wonderful film. It doesn't challenge me the way that that really wonderful films do, you know? Mm. It isn't a challenging film. I like a challenge. Most people don't when they're seeing films. Sometimes a challenge is too much, like for me, The Tree of Life.
But, okay.
Anyway. I'm sorry, I just killed the conversation, didn't I?
No, I'm just thinking deeply about what you're saying. I don't know, yeah. It's the
only film on the list that I've seen twice.
Moneyball?
Yeah. Really? I caught it in cinemas when it was released, and then I saw it on the plane on my way back from Christmas, and I loved it even more the second time I saw it. There's so much nuance in the performances. I'm a performance kind of guy. I love auteurist ideas when we have big directors saying huge things. And I think Bennett Miller, the director, did a really, really cool job. And the screenplay is just, it's out of control awesome. But the performances of Jonah Hill and Brad Pitt are really, really on the money, I thought.
Do you tend to follow actors and it kind of like, do you have actors that I'll see whatever they're in, even if it's not a great film, I want to see their performance kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. I do that too, yeah.
Who are your actors, just quickly?
Oh, like Tilda Swinton could make a movie called like, I'm making a sandwich and my name is Tilda Swinton. I'd go see it, you know. Anything, yeah. Anything she makes, I'll go see. Anything Ricky Gervais makes, I'll go see. Even though he makes a lot of bad things, I'll go see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just people that I just see it.
Yeah. Again, I'm an Emily Watson disciple. And I'll see anything that Von Trier does directorially. I tend to like a lot of Gus Van Sant's movies, so I'll go out of my way to catch his work.
Do you like... there's a movie that he made that I love that everybody hates. Jerry?
Yeah, yeah.
I love that movie.
It's not my favorite of his films, but I certainly do appreciate it a lot.
I never expected that to come from that director.
Right.
That kind of thing. And, yeah, that's like every one of that people love to hate that movie.
And the other person that I think that 2011 for me was the year of Melissa McCarthy. And
oh, right. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I've become a super fan. And so I think that she'll become one of those people that I will definitely follow quite...
whatever she does.
Yeah, whatever she does.
She seems like she could do a lot, too. She could be in a lot of different kinds of films.
Yeah. And her television series is remarkably full of heart. And
What's her show?
Called Mike and Molly. And she surprised everyone by winning the Best Actress in a comedy series at the Emmys this year. Beating like Laura Linney and and Amy Poehler and Martha Plimpton, all these like big actresses, and then she managed to trump them all, which was super cool. And now she's an Academy Award nominated actress, which is awesome.
Yeah, good for her. Yeah, that's awesome.
Well, you know, I don't follow stars at all. I mean, it's the same thing with opera. I don't care who the divas are, whoever. I'm into like operas and like the characters, but the singers, that's why it's sometimes when I see a movie and the star is so big, I find it a little annoying.
No, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. But I feel like I went through many, many phases of watching things in different ways, and now I kind of can switch modes. Like, for a while, it was all about the director. Like, I wouldn't see a movie unless I wanted to see that, you know what I mean? Like, it was like I was always chasing a director, and then it was like I'm always chasing a performer. Right. And now it just depends on, you know what I mean? It kind of depends on what's, like, going on.
Okay.
Like, yeah.
So let's talk about Midnight in Paris.
I'll probably end up going on another little hike tonight.
Where'd Gil run off to?
I've been walking around Paris.
Where do you think Gil goes every night?
He walks and gets ideas.
Why are you so dressed up?
I was just doing a little writing.
I saw it on a Sunday afternoon in New York, and I thought it was the most charming thing that I'd seen in quite a while, and I love Woody Allen. He doesn't always make the best movies. But when he's good, he's really good. And this movie's really good. And I was also a fan of Vicky Cristina, and I love Mighty Aphrodite. And I'm a fan of Annie Hall and Hannah and Her Sisters. It's sort of, you know, this... I was really, really impressed. And I thought that Owen Wilson was a nice stand-in for Woody. And I appreciated the performances of Marion Cotillard and Corey Stoll, who played Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah.
I adored his performance.
Yeah, I remember leaving the theater sort of buzzing, and I just really enjoyed the film, and I especially like it when Woody Allen has his, like, somewhat mystical side, like, you know, The Purple Rose of Cairo, where something a little bit magic happens. So Midnight in Paris has got a big thumbs up from me, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's talk about Hugo.
Where do you live? Is it a secret?
Yes.
Oh, good. I love secrets.
So you're all alone?
Not completely.
Where did you get this?
Why would my key fit into your father's machine?
Do you want to have an adventure?
Or is that a complicated awe?
No, this movie is really beautiful. It's stunning. It's a great, great movie from a great filmmaker. It is a little tough for that first hour. But in the second hour, it just takes flight and it becomes this thing that I was a huge fan. I walked out and the fellow I saw it with was just like, well, that was an amazing movie. That was, you know, that's a brilliant film.
Right.
And so I, you know, if it was able to upset in this category, I would be very happy. I don't think it has a shot in hell, but I would love to see Scorsese eke out that director win or Hugo take home the big prize. And it has the most nominations. Oh, and yeah. Historically, the film with the most nominations does take the prize, you know, quite often.
Well, yeah, no, we've actually mentioned Hugo on our show before because I actually picked up the book. But I picked up the book and, ooh, what's that loud noise?
Sorry, my chair.
Oh my. So I picked up the book and read it and absolutely loved it and thought, wow, this would make a great opera. And then a month later, found out it was being turned into a film. And I just love it. But I feel a little prejudiced because I have my heart already fell for it in the book, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I loved it. I also loved the
way. Well, that seems like you would have more of a tougher time getting into it. Most things that I've read before I see the movie, I'm unhappy with the movie after I've seen it, you know.
Oh, well, in this case, they took that book and went even further.
Mm.
They added a bunch of characters. There's more subtlety to it because the book is mostly pictures.
Mm.
It's all these beautiful drawings and then a little bit of text. So bringing it to reality on the film, plus adding this other dimension of the other characters and other stories, actually, it expanded the book for me.
Right, right.
Okay, let's go to the next one, The Help.
Tell Abilene.
Do I have plans for her?
You are godless woman.
We gone done it now.
I understand that it's not necessarily cool, especially in academic circles.
I haven't seen it, and I just don't know how I'm gonna feel about it, you know?
Why?
Because I'm afraid that it's going to be like white people patting themselves on the back. It's not.
There's a bit of that.
There's some.
But even a little bit of that is too much of that.
Okay.
No, I mean, like, I think I maybe should see it because it's unfair to criticize something that I see. But, you know, that's why I've been wary of it.
Well, this film totally took me in and I was completely enthralled in it. What I like about it is no one is a hero in this movie, really. I mean, what this woman does with the, you know, and what happens to all of these characters is embarrassing and despicable. And what, you know, no one's a clear good person in this. Like,
okay.
I like that. I don't know. What do you think, Royce?
I think it's a really fun summer blockbuster. And, you know, in a category, you know, wondering whether this award should go to a piece of art or a piece of populist whatever, It's really, really interesting that this film, first of all, has made more money than any other picture in this lineup, and that it is female centric. And that's, I think that's pretty cool. I really, again, loved the performances. It's probably going to win 2 Oscars for its actresses, which will be the first time ever that 2 black performers or 2 black actresses will win Oscars. Of course, we did have the year that Denzel Washington and Halle Berry won, but for the first time, we most likely will see 2 black actresses take home trophies, which is also a really cool happenstance. It shouldn't be such a cool happenstance, but alas, it is. I was really taken by it. I thought it was really fun. I was held captive for an hour and however many minutes in the middle of summer.
Yeah, and I really appreciated it because, think about it, you called it a summer blockbuster, and what was the subject matter? Usually a summer blockbuster is, you know, robots killing aliens, and it was really refreshing that this film is not about that. And it's actually about, it's a very serious issue that people don't, you know, we don't all like to talk about. I mean, just to put this in perspective, you know, the French have never had a single historian publish a book about their involvement in World War II. They don't talk about it. In America, we have this horrible history, and we talk about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you should cut that
out. No, well, wait a minute. That's a good point, though. I think that that's true. That's something I think Americans know very intimately, the idea of discussing race and discussing class very much out in the open. Conversations about race and class, it seem to be more prevalent here than they are other places. I don't know if that's true, but it feels like that's true.
You know, it's a movie about written by a white man based on a white woman's novel, and it does have a little bit of that patting on the back of how white people, you know, a white person did good for this black community. But looking at those demographics again, Oscar voters are nearly 94% Caucasian with a median age of 62. This movie is, a lot of people are saying that if anything was legitimately poised to upset in this race, it would be The Help. And you can actually see, looking at those demographics, that there might be a few that are excited to pat themselves on the back a little bit more.
It actually
feels a little bit to me like a Forrest Gump. It has that glossy, blockbuster sort of sheen.
So now let's talk about The Descendants.
Alex?
Dad? What's up, Dad? What's happening?
You need to come home and see your mom. I'm the backup parent. The understudy.
I thought you were supposed to be getting your act together.
I've been doing really well, actually. Nobody ever seems to notice that.
And with Elizabeth, my wife, in the hospital, my daughters are testing me.
Look who's here. Get out of my underwear, you freak.
Oh, okay.
I've only heard great things.
Really?
Yeah, I've only heard really good things.
All right, let's say something not great about it.
Peter, what did you think?
You know, I liked the film. I enjoyed watching it. I don't think it was a great movie. I just sat there thinking, you know, George Clooney's playing himself again, and he got in the way for me of really engaging in the story. It was just so much about him, you know? It's like, well, why don't we just set up a camera in this guy's living room and give him an award?
Well, he's not going to win the award this year. So so that's, you know.
Has he ever won an Oscar?
He has. He won a few years ago for Syriana in the supporting actor race.
Oh, I hated that movie. Okay. I'm hating.
But he already has one on his mantle, so he's good for a while. But there was a lot of talk early in the season that it was his to lose, but then later developments snatched that Oscar away from him. If he was to win, it would be a huge upset right now. This juncture in the race.
So what do you think of the film?
I liked the film. I encouraged one of my collaborators to go see it. We're both mutual Alexander Payne fans. I loved Citizen Ruth, loved Election, loved about Schmidt and Sideways.
Mm-hmm.
The more I think about it, the more I love the performances, and the film just isn't, you know, it isn't my favorite, but I still find a lot of value in it. I was pleasantly surprised at the time how I really fell for it. But it certainly, I will agree with said anonymous collaborator that it isn't Alexander Payne's finest hour.
Right.
Mm.
But it looks like they're going to take the screenplay prize. So I actually think that the script is quite nice.
Was it humorous in the same way that most of his films, although they're the ones that I've seen are really dark, they're very funny though. I mean, I can remember, you know, things that are just, I mean, I remember from About Schmidt, just Jack Nicholson's voice going, "Dear Undugu," like that's going to be there as something funny for me for the rest of my life. Like, I just think, you know what I mean? Is it funny in that level, at that level at all?
I think it's more funny on the level of Sideways, maybe.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's also, it's about, you know, it has a huge death at the center of this film.
Right.
So it is a little, it's on the darker side of Payne's offerings. It certainly isn't at the level of Election or About Schmidt.
Right. Okay.
Or even Citizen Ruth, for that matter. But there are certainly moments of levity.
Okay. So now let's move to the last film, The Artist. It's a wonderful film, and also left the movie going, well, that's what film can be, you know?
Do you think it has a chance at winning?
I mean,
chance of winning. What are you guys? What planet are you guys on? This movie has the Oscar.
You think so? Really?
Oh my god! They should mail it to France this afternoon. Oh my god! It is a shoo-in. There is no other movie on this list that can win. Every precursor that it needed to. It's completely captured Hollywood.
But
it's the only movie that was filmed in Hollywood, which has been another talking point that a lot of the press has brought up lately. It has this Oscar. You can mark that on your ballots right now.
Oh, there you go, Peter.
Well, there you have it.
This is your Oscars.
Okay, so now I'm going to bring our Oscar discussion to an end because my laptop's battery is running low. And I also want to say that we actually have a winner in our Indie Opera Podcast contest.
Yes!
Well, someone actually got it right.
Yes.
And the winner who guessed this particular clip, let's play it one more time. Here it is. I could make no sense of what I'd seen in terms of conventional neurology. How could a professional musician, a practicing teacher, mistake his wife for a hat? We have Randall Ng, who is a wonderful composer, and I'd love to get on the show because he actually was listening to our podcast and he guessed correctly that this was The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat.
By composer Michael Nyman.
Michael Nyman. Now listen, we made it so easy. I mean, I know the first time we had the clip and no one guessed it, I was like, okay, let's make this easy. The title of the opera was in the clip.
He true. Actually... Yeah, but you know what? When you're teaching, like, public school, the first thing you do with any student is just you give them a task that is so easy that they have to be able to be successful at it because, you know, you build trust and all that stuff. So this is like our teaching contest, right? We're kind of building building a space for this to happen again.
Okay.
Right?
So Randall is also, he's not only is he super talented, but he's also extremely smart. So it makes sense that he would get that.
Yeah, I mean,
Randall.
We probably bored him, is what you're saying. Maybe.
So congratulations, Randall. We will contact you soon. And I think you have a choice among three. Is that what it is? Three different DVDs? What is it?
Yes, choice among three. Let me see. I'm going to go grab them. Hold on one second. So one is the Ghost of Versailles. The
World Company.
Was that a bad prize?
No, that's great. I want that.
And then the other one is Strauss Elektra. Strauss's Elektra with Hildegard Behrens and Deborah Voigt. And they're both at the Met Opera, Metropolitan Opera Chorus. And
Orchestra,
James Levine conducting.
Those are great choices. I want both of them.
You can't have them.
Yeah. So thank you for listening. This is Peter.
And this is Noah.
And this is Royce.
And thanks for listening to the podcast. See you. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
We'd like to thank Royce Vavrick for joining us today in our discussion, as well as Elena Langer. Today's show was edited by both Noah and me. Got Stitcher? We are on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.